Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host, researcher, minister, and friend, Charles Paisley, the founder of ChristianGospelChurch.org and the author of Come Out of Her, My People. Charles, it's good to be back and to talk all things spread of Branhamism. And today it's a little bit interesting for me because this is a subject that just really fascinates me, and that is the religious propaganda. I first came across the notion of propaganda as it relates to the message and Pentecostalism in general when I was researching Branhamism and I was publishing a few things, and somebody sent me an old issue of John Alexander Dowie's newsletter, which was called Leaves of Healing, I think it was. And the person didn't give me any information with it, just the newsletter. So I didn't know what to do with it, but I read it, and suddenly I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy, he's like another Branham. What year is this? And I look at the top, and I knew nothing about John Alexander Dowie, but I found out that he was basically the prototype for the Faith Healing Revivals. And so he's, that newsletter, believe it or not, sparked my interest and curiosity in him. And that's part of the reason why I wrote this Militant Christian Extremism, A Critical Examination of John Alexander Dowie. And just researching the man, found out that he was just one of the greatest con artists that has ever lived, man. He made millions of dollars. In today's money, it's probably billions of dollars. And what he did was ingenious, because through that newsletter, people would read it, and no matter what he put in it, because it was a quote-unquote Christian newsletter, people believed it. They shut off critical thinking, they read it, and if he published that he was the greatest healer known to mankind, there were people who flocked all over to come see him. So he set the stage for what was to come. And then, you know, in latter rain, you had the Voice of Healing publication. You actually had a few different publications, which that in itself isn't so bad. It's the fact that they're unchecked. There is no, whatever the publisher says that they're doing, that's what they're doing. And then prior to this, I found a newspaper article in Jeffersonville, Indiana. Roy Davis, William Branham's mentor, also had a newsletter, and he was publishing it from his printing presses in Jeffersonville, and he was doing the same thing, but he took it a step further. He was taking notes, and he was passing it to newspaper reporters and say, hey, this happened in my church. I just raised the dead or healed the sick, whatever it was. And he was wanting to force the newspapers to print his miracles. Come to find out that, you know, they also were unchecked, and the newspaper reporters just shut him down and said, look, man, we have to have some evidence of these things that you're saying. So that brings us to today. We're going to get into some of the, we were talking about Faith Assembly last week, but we're going to get into some of the propaganda that's spreading through the Contender, and I'm sure that's going to be a hot topic for you and your sect.
It is really fascinating, isn't it, John, how this stuff works? You mentioned John Alexander Dowie there. You know, if you think about the ideology, kind of like I've mentioned in the past, as a boom and a bust cycle, John Alexander Dowie would be five cycles ago of this ideology, if you count backward from the NAR. And you're right, with every iteration of this ideology, there are certain evolutions of the ideology, there's certain concepts or practices that get introduced. And one of the things that John Alexander Dowie did, right, he introduced this literature, John. He introduced creating these magazines, these newsletter type things that he would spread to the ends of the world through his cult. Because he had, even though he was mostly centered here in Zion, he concentrated a lot of his followers in Zion, starting in the 1880s, 1890s, he had actually a whole network of followers and churches all around the English-speaking world. And it was actually even through that newsletter that he announced that he was building Zion and encouraged them all to move to Zion, where they could all live under his reign of, you know, horrors and stuff that ensued up there. But yeah, I mean, the newsletter, the propaganda piece, that's a very interesting thing. And you're correct. You see that then repeated in every cycle that comes afterwards. They are all having these religious type newsletters that are going around that are spreading the ideology of the movement and I guess what you would say is pushing the party line. And you get like the Voice of Healing, you get On Down, Spoken Word. And one of the things I did want to talk about leading in today, John, was the publication that came out of my sect of the message. I got a copy. This is the very first edition of The Contender, John.
Wow.
Volume one. They came out, they were like a newspaper in style. And you could, you know, usually multiple pages. They were long enough that you could fit, there were enough space in here for three full transcripts of three full sermons of you know, whoever, you know, they were publishing or what have you. So, and you're correct. I mean, and it's very important. And I think one thing I want to draw some attention to is the importance of the literature in all of this. When you look at the sects of the message that had the biggest success early on growing, it really seems it's more the ones that had good literature, John. And by good literature, I mean effective, well-wrote, easily communicated, easily accessible, a large library of it that were successful. If you go back to the very early days of the movement, John, William Branham's transcripts that were not all available when he died, not by any means. There was actually just a very few of his sermons, maybe 30 of his sermons were available in print when he died. And when you think about the mission outreach overseas to other countries, well, if you think about Africa and South America and India and all that back then, well, they didn't have tape players, John. I mean, they were impoverished. You know, it'd be a year's salary for them to buy tape players. Tapes was not an option. You had to have literature in order to convey the beliefs back then, because you couldn't pass out tapes like you can now or give people tablets like they do now. You had to have literature. And it was the groups that had the really good literature that were able to get the forefront of the ability to push the message. Ewald Frank, for example, we'll talk some episodes about his sect. His sect actually made all the original foreign language translations besides Spanish. Every other, you know, up through the 80s, 90s, it would be really the mid and late 90s by the time Voice of God's actually caught up with them in terms of translations. So he had more or less the monopoly on all of the foreign language translations. And the English stuff, the English literature was really down to my sect, John, and the sect you come from, and spoken word publications in the early days. And we're going to do some full episodes on Lee Vail too, but there was some decisions made early on to print all of William Branham's sermons in English verbatim. And when you have William Branham sermons, they're in little booklets like this nowadays. They've changed colors. I've got some older ones on the shelf I could pull off. But these sermons are verbatim transcripts of William Branham. And whenever he coughs, whenever he sneezes, whenever he misspeaks, you know, and all of his unique hillbilly grammar, I guess you'd call it, is all in there, right? And the truth is, to a lot of people outside of the United States who speak English even, his sermons are unintelligible. You know, like the way they printed them, it is very, very challenging for people to read. If people who are non-native English speakers find them very challenging. And what happened in the early days, John, the early message missionaries would actually pass out copies of The Contender along with copies of The Spoken Word. And they were sort of like a guide to help deal, you know, a summary form of what, you know, William Branham taught, but without all the broken language. It was, you know, edited, it was clean, it was easy to read. And Ewald Frank would distribute those, for example, alongside in the churches he planted, the English-speaking people. Others did the same thing. And so that gave, that is really what gave our sect of the message a strong entrance in some of the missionary pushes, because our literature was going alongside some of the spoken word literature and stuff, especially in the early days when there just wasn't as much English literature coming out of spoken word. And even afterwards, when everything was just wrote verbatim of William Branham, and it was very challenging for the non-English speakers to read it. Because Voice of God themselves didn't have any really non-English content. They started to develop some Spanish stuff, you know, later on. But other than that, they didn't really have anything else to share. And so that I think helps explain a little bit of how my sect of the message was able to be effective through some of the mission stuff. It was through the publication of our literature.
And again, publication of literature is not unique, especially, you know, you can go back and as early as there is a way to print information, there are people who are distributing information. That's just how it works. In fact, early Pentecostalism, there's somewhat of a scandal that I read about. I assume it's true, but whenever the Azusa Street Revival was happening and whenever William Joseph Seymour was out, you know, leading the masses as Pentecostalism, modern Pentecostalism, start that all over. And you know, printing information and distributing it is nothing new. You can go back as far as history records, because history has recorded, we have information and people are distributing it. In fact, early Pentecostalism, there were newsletters and newsletter subscriptions. And whenever William Joseph Seymour was out in Los Angeles during the Azusa Street Revival, there's a scandal that apparently broke out. I read about this. I don't know if it's true or not, but I'm assuming it is. It was a reputable source. But he had one of the most powerful things that he had during the Azusa Street Revivals was the names and addresses of people, and that was his distribution list. And I'm told that Lucy Farrell ended up stealing that list from him. So he lost a lot of the power, and the power just kind of spread. Now, again, I don't know if that, I've not been able to confirm it other than the one source that I found. So take that with a grain of salt. But there is power in the newsletter list, because the people who subscribe to it are essentially your assets. And as you're growing and birthing any business, you have customers, right? So whenever you have these newsletters, you have customers. Well, in the concept of a cult and a cult's propaganda, these are your, number one, potential converts. Many true converts have taken it. But this is the means by which you can distribute the information that your cult wants to share in a way that you can control that information so that it sounds more believable. And that's the key to all of this, is making the information of the cult sound more believable, which is essentially propaganda.
The contender from Faith Assembly, John, in case our listeners don't know, I mean, I've said this several times, I'm formerly the associate pastor of the second oldest message church in the world, which printed this document, John. And before I left, among the many, many posts and positions I held in the movement, I was editor of all of our literature as well, John. So I know a lot about the circulation and everything of all of this stuff and the history of it. So, the literature started, we started publishing this in the 1960s, and to the best of my knowledge, this is the second oldest set of message literature. Like, this is the second oldest message publication, and it's been in continuous printing since the 60s, John, shortly after William Branham's death. The original editor of the Contender was a man named Homer Brown. Homer Brown was the associate pastor of Bill Pederis in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. And after, you know, I've mentioned how his church imploded, after the event with his wife, Homer Brown ended up moving to Jeffersonville, and along with Raymond Jackson, they started to publish, the magazine with Homer Brown as editor. And as they did that, John, the Contender just has grown into one of the most comprehensive sets of systematized beliefs of the message out there. It's basically every topic of the message dealt with in a systematic fashion. And it really is kind of unique in that way. Lee Vail done something similar through some of his sermons, but I would say it's one of the most unique things out there in the message as far as a fully comprehensive system of, you could almost say it's an attempt at systematic theology for the message, is probably the best way to describe what's attempted to be done with it. And as it you know, went out in circulation, John, you know, at the high point, it had 30,000 subscribers in circulation. It was a very, you know, widely distributed publication. And that's part of one of the ways that I, in my book, for example, I tried to measure some of the size of my sect of the message. I think the high end would be this, the subscription rate on the literature. And so, yeah, at the high point, 30,000 people, John, were subscribing to The Contender in the 1980s, 1990s. It was pretty widely distributed, and lots of other sects of the message, though, subscribed to it as well, right? Lots of people in other sects. So they, not everybody getting it was in my sect of the message. Now, one thing I do want to say about the Contender too, John, is Homer Brown, so the editor, he started in the 1970s, about 1976, I want to say, 75, 76. Homer Brown decided that he wanted to publish material in there from preachers besides Raymond Jackson. Okay, so up in the early days, it was just all Raymond Jackson's teachings in there, right? His version of the message. But in 75, 76, Homer Brown decides to start putting other preachers' sermons and content in the magazine as well. Okay, that did not go over well with Raymond Jackson, okay? He was not willing to share the pages with anybody. And that is actually the basis behind what ended up leading him to push Homer Brown out of the church. Now, of course, they concocted, you know, crazy ideas to say Homer Brown was a bad guy. But the truth is, Homer Brown had started to put preachers in there besides Raymond Jackson. And Raymond Jackson ended up looking for a pretense to get rid of Homer Brown in order to continue to be the only one in the magazine. And among the people, I will say, John, that Homer Brown published in The Contender in that period of time was Freddie Bradford, the Canadian child molester, okay? He's among the other ministers that... Wow. Homer Brown decided to put in there in those years. So anyways, all that happened. Homer Brown ended up leaving out, and he went and he planted a new church in Florida where he remained as a pastor until he died with a version of our sect of the message's teachings. There were so many topics we put in The Contender, John. I'll get you some screenshots maybe you can put up for people. But we printed The Latter Rain by name. We printed Manifested Sons of God by name. The terminology changed over the years, but it was still by name in the earlier years we were publishing that. We published multi-series articles on the life of William Branham and how our sect of the message viewed him. We tackled all the major topics of the message, the Son of Man teachings, you know, the return ministry stuff was tackled in there. All the beliefs, the church ages, head full spreads, the seals, you know, every topic that mattered to the message was in there. In addition to some of the unique topics of Faith Assembly, and one of the unique beliefs of Faith Assembly, I know we've mentioned this a few times, John, it's called "The Fan Is in His Hand." Okay, and you know, anybody listening just hearing that phrase, like, what in the world could that possibly mean? The fan is in his hand. But in our sect of the message, that's a teaching that basically meant William Branham taught things wrong on purpose to deceive the people who were not elect and confuse them.
Wow. And
the fan is in his hand. And so it's basically the get out of jail free card for basically William Branham could say and do anything wrong or bad, or teach or say or do anything wrong or bad, and we say the fan is in his hand, and that was just to deceive the non-elect, and we have the true version of the message here. So that was our mental gymnastics for not believing in elements of what William Branham taught, and then continuing on with our stuff. That's in there. There's so much stuff, John. I mean, it's just a mountain of literature. It's been published for, you know, over 50 years now, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of editions. The total length of the thing is longer than two or three Bibles at this stage, all the content. So it is it's quite an undertaking. But again, I really wanted to point that out because it's very important to the early spread of the message, and because we were kind of at the cutting edge of having a lot of literature in English that could go out with the missionaries and the mission work that was happening in the early days of the message.
It's just really unbelievable when you think about it. And what you're describing is, I'm trying not to laugh because the whole scenario is kind of funny. The same thing happened with William Branham during the early years of Latter Rain as he's publishing the Voice of Healing magazine. This publication began as his tool to gather assets. And remember, his one gimmick that he's still famous for today, they still talk about it today, is that he could guess the names and addresses, and that was his stage act. So he'd go up for healing, and he would say, you live at certain address, and therefore be healed. Well, he's got a subscription, man. Subscription service gives you names and addresses, which is interesting. I know there's a lot more to it than that, and that's another topic for another discussion. But what happened was kind of funny. It began as his publication to advertise his ministry. And he and Gordon Lindsay and others realized how powerful this was and that they could create sort of a pyramid scheme with it. So they started inviting other ministers to advertise their ministries in it. And I can't say this for certain, but knowing how these guys think, probably there was some sort of a subscription tier. If you got your name if you got published, you were bound to get a huge audience. So I'm certain that to get your name in the newspaper, they had to get a little bit of kickback. But that's my opinion. That's a guess. I don't know how it worked. But what happened is once they started doing this, other ministers started claiming angels and demons and special visitations and all kinds of gifts that are just absurd when you read through some of those early letters, right? Those early editions. And what essentially started happening is the focus started shifting away from William Branham, and he got really, really upset about it. And there was a early parting of ways. I'm not certain how all that came to be. I know there were some mental health issues with Branham, but I have to believe that some of the early fights that they had were probably based on the fact that, no, man, these other guys are getting all my attention, and I want the sole attention. This was a newsletter supposed to be advertising my ministry. Now it's all these other guys.
Wow. Yeah. So I know in our last episode, we more or less talked through some of the major events of My Sect of the Message up to the 1980s. The start of the Contender was one of them. We didn't. I wanted to make sure we noted. But kind of picking back up in the 80s, John, you know, we went through, our churches went through a series of schisms in those years. We started to actually have some of the figures that we looked at as apostles started to break away. Richard Gann broke away. Ben Howard broke away. I kind of mentioned those already. But besides, you know, those things happened, we also had a number of other just significant schisms in those years. We had a man by the name of Brad Burgess, who I'm sure you probably know, John, who's the pastor of a notable message church here in the Jeffersonville area. They broke away from our sect of the message in the 1980s. And another fairly notable thing that happened in the early 90s was another prominent minister. His name was Rockwell Lance. He was probably among the most prominent of our ministers in India. Broke away with some of the Indian churches and also part of the following here in North America and South Africa as well. So, you know, we were having schisms through all that period of time over weird stuff too, over really weird stuff. Like the schism with Brad Burgess was over at Faith Assembly, women were allowed to trim their hair, but at Brad Burgess's church, they were not. The schism ensued, John. Yeah. Okay? That one was a knockdown dragout, too, John. It devolved into a massive shouting match at one of the international conventions, of course. Yeah. Right? That's where it always started at.
I just had a conversation about that last evening whenever I was with some people who had just left the message, and they were talking about the cutting of hair thing. And William Branham said in the questions and answers that it's okay for women to trim their bangs. So what your sect had was actually doing what William Branham said. And take that a step further. The daughters of William Branham, you look at their photographs, they're wearing skirts above their knees, they've got their hair trimmed, and Raymond Jackson knew them. He knew that. And my family knew them. They knew that the Branham daughters were like this, and it was okay in the Branham household. But what happened is he would preach so hard against women cutting their hair that nobody else, anybody who had not seen his family and not knew that this is how the Branham family lived, they were just very hardcore against cutting of hair of any kind. So all these schisms emerge because people have learned the doctrine from the Stage Act rather and the recordings of the Stage Act, the propaganda, and they've not actually seen the guy and the way he lived and the lifestyle. So the two are completely separate.
That schism that happened, let me just talk about that schism just a little bit, John, because I think if I describe how that one unfolded, it can help our listeners understand how schisms work in the message, especially in my sect of the message. So basically, you know, you're at the International Convention. Brad Burgess stands up and basically rips Raymond Jackson up one side and down the other for an hour straight. Okay. Raymond Jackson's sitting there the whole time. Okay. Wow. That's how it works. It just rips, tears into him, you know, and so when it's all done, you could hear a pin drop. I mean, it is dead silent. And as Brad Burgess sits back down, it's just absolute silence, and nobody wants to go up to the podium after. Like, nobody will get up. And this is happening in Raymond Jackson's church, John. Okay. and Raymond Jackson don't even get up to the platform. He just kind of sits there. And finally, John, one of the ministers from, rather one of the deacons at Faith Assembly stands up and says, I support Raymond Jackson 100%, and I just don't think that this was right. And then he goes and sits back down. And then a preacher from Canada get up, and one by one, everybody gets up. I support Raymond Jackson 100%, and this was. And by the time you get to the 30th person doing that, right, the crowd is starting to get angry and riled, and Brad Burgess is eventually very forcibly expelled from the church. It's just like it builds, and that's how it would work at our church. And Raymond, and it's really, it's all, I would say it's almost with that event with Brad Burgess when it started this thing at Faith Assembly, where whenever anything, the slightest bit bad happened, the pastor, Raymond Jackson, or his successor would sit back. And it would be the job of all the other people in the church to be flying monkeys to descend upon whoever was the offender, right? And disparage them. And over the years, it evolved, John. It evolved into sometimes two or three service-long episodes where everybody would say everything bad they ever knew about the person who, you know, was on the receiving end of it. And just scorched earth their person, right? You know, every bad thing they ever did, basically they're possessed by the devil. They're going to hell. And let's not just throw them out. Let's find everyone who is in their family and throw them out too, because they're related to them and they probably sympathize with them, even though we don't know anything about it. But that's when it started. This kind of thing started in the 80s in our sect of the message, John. And it was so ugly. And over the years, there were so many people schismed and thrown out this way, and it got incredibly hostile. And I laugh, you know, I can kind of laugh about it now, but you know, back then it was frightening stuff when you're a kid growing up in this stuff. I remember one service, John. Something along this line happened. There was a particular woman in the church that was going to be thrown out. This was also in the 80s, and Raymond Jackson stands up at the platform and he says, "Everybody, look straight ahead. Nobody look left. Nobody look right. Look straight ahead. I am going to deal with this." And he just rips into this woman, John. Rips her up one side, down the other. She's weeping and crying. Has her throat out of the church, right? Wow. And everybody's sitting there like this. Because he said, look straight ahead. Don't look left or right.
It sounds like something straight out of Nazi Germany, man.
I'm telling you, John. I mean, it was crazy. So a lot of crazy stuff happened. Maybe one day I should give you like just talk about crazy things that happened in our churches, John. I mean, we could talk for hours and hours and hours and hours just about the crazy things that happened in the churches I come from. But yeah, that sort of thing set up then, and that's how schisms and these things would unfold as people got expelled.
Yeah, it's just really hard to believe the way that some of the ministers behave. In a normal world, normal people don't act like this. But it's, well, I take that back. If you're like 5 years old, maybe you act like that if you're a bully. But some of these ministers, man, they really don't care about the people. And I'm laughing because it's absurd, but it's really sad. The people are so programmed and so manipulated. And largely due to all of this propaganda that's being spread, they're under such fear of the minister. They think he's got basically he's got supernatural powers. He's their direct channel to God in some cases. And they sit there in fear and they let him verbally abuse them. I've been in services where this has happened. My own grandfather verbally abused a woman. She had just got up and sang a special, and he didn't like, he called it a scandal skirt. And we have a commenter on the feeds that just thought this was the funniest thing ever. You can see it in the comment feeds on YouTube. But he said she's wearing a scandal skirt because she had this little tiny slit. I want to say it was no bigger than 4 inches, right? In the back of her skirt. You couldn't even see the calves of her ankles. That's how long her skirt was. But as she's walking back, because she had that slit, he railed her the whole time until I was watching her walk, and she started just bawling about halfway, and she left, and I'm not certain that she ever came back. So these ministers are really driving people away from Christianity altogether in some cases, but at minimum, they're driving people out of the church, and it's sad the way they abuse the people. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
Some of the people that go through that are cracked in such a way that they never recover. I've seen that in quite a few cases. And I've also seen a number of cases where they go home and commit suicide after as well. I mean, that's not uncommon, John. And I mean, there's multiple graves in Eastern Cemetery of people who went home and killed themselves, right? Out of fear of what the message preacher was going to do to them. Yeah, it's very, very unfortunate stuff. So that was happening in the 80s, you know. We also had one other really notable thing I want to talk about that happened. It started in the 80s, late 80s, and kind of continued on into the early 90s. And I'm just going to kind of mention it in passing here, John, because down the road, we're going to do a more full episode on maybe the disappearance of Sarah Branham when we talk about the main sect. But in the 1980s, Sarah Branham started her, I don't know just what to call it, a crusade against the central institutions of the message. I think that's how I'll phrase it. Sarah Branham's crusade against the central institutions of the message. And she had went around basically trying to get the senior leaders of the major message sects on her side, right? She'd started with Joseph Coleman, who took her side. She went to Ewald Frank, who took her side. She came to Raymond Jackson, who took her side. And as she went through those different things, she ended up choosing Raymond Jackson, probably because he was here in Jeffersonville, to more or less be her mediator with the central institutions and with Billy Paul and Joseph. Billy Paul more so than anything else. And Raymond Jackson kind of rose to that occasion, John, because as Sarah Branham came, she came with like this massive stack of documents that her and her lawyers had compiled, which, again, Raymond Jackson loved to collect the dirt. It had all of the criminal activity of Perry Green in it, John. It had all kinds of criminal stuff going on in the main sect of the message, you know, with the Evans family, with the Branham family, with Perry Green, with go on down, Roy Borders, all kinds of stuff is in there that they were all involved in all this, you know, terrible stuff. Several of them had went to prison even. I mean, yeah, I think you know several of them went to prison. And anyways, it was really bad. It was all really bad stuff. And Raymond Jackson, when he got a hold of this, like, it was like Someone had made his day, John. I'm telling you, his day was made. And here comes Sarah. So this is his chance. This is Faith Assembly's chance to finally, you know, the main sect has knifed them in the back so many times. This is Raymond Jackson's chance to pull a big one back on the main sect. And let me tell you, that's exactly what he was doing, John. And so he wrote, you know, this really nasty letter to Billy Paul. You actually have it on your website. Yeah. I think he basically calls Billy Paul a dog in that letter, don't he? And it is incredibly nasty. And he's doing all this on Sarah's behalf, right? And he basically inserts himself and becomes Sarah's mediator to the rest of the Branham family. And Faith Assembly, we set up a trust in those years, collected money to help sponsor and take care of Sarah. You know, all that stuff happened. And I think it was Raymond Jackson's mind, it was going to be his attempt to win people out of the main sect to our sect. And so he did that, John. And I'll back up just a little bit, too. Earlier in the 90s, when Ewald Frank had a sex scandal, Raymond Jackson did a very similar thing when he found out about that. Faith Assembly ministers went around basically followed Ewald Frank around Africa. They would tail him to churches, and then they would expose his affair, right, on the tail end. So he would leave, and then they'd come in and expose his affair. He'd leave, then they'd come and expose his affair. And the same thing, peel off some of Ewald Frank's people in Africa. So Raymond Jackson there was a pattern of doing this by the time Sarah Branham comes around. And so when Sarah Branham comes around, he goes whole hog, John. And he had private meetings with George Smith about it, with Rebecca Smith, with Billy Paul about it. I don't know that he ever actually met Joseph about any of it, because I think Joseph was still something we won't say right here, but he was not available to be talked to. We'll leave it at that. But Raymond Jackson had private meetings with the rest of them. He recorded all those, John. I don't know if any of them know he did, but he did record all those meetings. And again, I was set up to be Raymond Jackson's successor, ladies and gentlemen. I have everything. I have every last thing that was in that man's possession. So at any rate, that was going on in the late 80s. And it eventually, of course, you know what happens. The whole thing kind of ended mysteriously and Sarah disappeared. But that was a really big thing happening in the late 80s and early 90s in the Faith Assembly Fellowship. There were multiple closed meetings about that, private church services where Raymond Jackson would keep everybody updated and things like that was going on. But it was a huge deal what was happening with Sarah in those years. And I know it was especially a huge deal for our churches because Raymond Jackson was being the mediator, but I think it was a pretty big deal throughout most of the message community back then, John, especially in North America, in Europe, because Sarah was directly interacting with a lot of the people and riling a lot of that up.
Yeah, and my family, I've got one family member that was in contact with Sarah during all of this, and the stories that could be told, man, it's unbelievable. You know, and Sarah's hands weren't entirely clean. She was the victim, if you read her letter and understand what's happening. Her brothers were not treating her fairly, and she was, I can confirm through family members that she was destitute and her children did not have food, while her rich brothers were purposefully cutting her off from, wouldn't help her at all. I'll just say it like that. You can read the letter. I think it's called Take It With You or something like this. You can find it on the website. But she was very much in need. I'll say it like that. But she knew how to play all the sides. She knew that all of these ministers in the cult acted like bullies. And if you can put a bully against a bully, you're going to have a fight. And so that's exactly what she did.
And she knew that the sex of the message would compete to win her. She was a prize to be won.
Yes, exactly.
And she knew that the leaders of the different sects would go above and beyond in order to win a member of the Branham family, one of William Branham's children, to their church. And that's exactly what was happening, John. The sects of the message were competing to win Sarah to their sect of the message. And that went on a while. Like I said, we'll talk about some of that in detail, John, when we get to the main sect, and maybe talk into that a little bit more. But fascinating stuff to look back then, John. I didn't fully grasp what was happening in those years. Like, I remember I was there when all those stuff happened, but it didn't really sink in precisely what was happening as far as, because you're indoctrinated, right? And the prophet's daughter is being mistreated by her evil brothers who have been subsumed by the deity cult. We must help her, you know? You don't see all the other aspects of it, right? Where, yeah, they are in the deity cult and all that stuff, but this is a power play by our leaders, and in a lot of ways, Sarah kind of turned into a pawn through that, right, as well. Not only were they competing over, she kind of got turned into a pawn through that whole ordeal. And then the disappearance happens, which, like I said, we'll talk about that later.
You know, and for the NAR people who are listening and they're curious to learn more about who is this foundation from which all of the NAR has been built, and did he really go astray at the end, or was he always somewhat of a character? You can look at William Branham, you can look at what he established, you can look at the cult that was created, and just look at the way the people behave in this and ask yourselves the question, was the Holy Spirit involved in this movement, or was this something else? Was there some other kind of spirit? And think of this, Charles. We've said it a few times, but in any city that has a concentration of message believers, you're bound to have more than one church. I know that there are some cities that have one church, but by and large, you've either got multiple main churches, or at minimum, a church and a bunch of people who are gathering in their homes, because they start fighting and they can't agree with each other. So they split, they separate, the home church grows into a church with a physical building. There is nothing but confusion, separation, anger, and I just have to believe that the Holy Spirit was not involved in this movement at all.
You know, John, when you come into the early 1990s, right as this Sarah Branham stuff kind of fizzles out, right? Almost at the same time that it hit its pinnacle, something happened in our fellowship of churches, John. And it's something that we would refer to as an outpouring of the Holy Spirit in our churches. Now, I think, you know, if you're from Pentecostalism, you kind of know what that means, okay? And so it's an outpouring of the Holy Spirit in the terminology of this religion. And it starts out, John, I believe it began in 1993. It started just before the Toronto Blessing, actually. Just before the Toronto Blessing happened, about a year and a half before the Toronto Blessing began, this started in our churches. And it's characterized by extreme ecstatic worship, okay? Speaking in tongues, running, shupping, jumping, shouting, dancing, you know, rolling around on the floor, slain in the spirit, all this sort of stuff, John. And I'm not talking about just like it's happening to one or two people. I mean, hundreds of people are engaging in this at the same time simultaneously in the church services, okay? It's something you just almost have to be in it even to fully grasp it, just what this is. But if you look at the Toronto Blessing, it was exactly the same sort of thing you see there, except this was happening actually a few years before that in our churches. And so this started a new phase in our churches. Our churches had always been ecstatic in the worship and embracing the gifts of the Spirit, but this started a new level, John. You know, in the message, just like the NAR people, we're chasing the last day revival, right? Where this great outpouring is going to happen and everyone's going to be empowered with all the gifts of the Spirit in this great mighty way, and the end of days will come. Well, when this happened, of course, that's naturally what our leaders told us was happening. It was the end of day revival occurring, okay?
Yeah.
And as that happened, that started, I want to say it was like 93, 94. Right in that same window of time, the Sarah Branham stuff happened. It looked like the main sect was finally getting what they deserved, you know. And Also, John, Raymond Jackson in that time introduced what I think is his chief legacy. It's called The Countdown is On. Here's a copy of the very first time he ever preached this. It was from, we'll get you some better views of this, but September 5th, 1993. Looking Through Windows of Prophecy, Part 2. Raymond Jackson began to introduce a concept he used of scriptures in Hosea 6:2, and he made all kinds of elaborate charts. This is just a little one that was shipped out with the tape when he first preached it. And in this calculation, John, the long and the short of it is, Raymond Jackson is saying the week of Daniel is going to start somewhere by the year 2005. Okay, this is what he's saying. The week of Daniel, the final doomsday scenario will begin by 2005, and Jesus Christ will end up coming again. There'll be the rapture, all that. And, you know, by all of his calculations, we should be living in the millennial age right now, and the end of the world should have already happened, okay? So he sets that up, John, in 1993, and he's got a pretty good runway there, right? I mean, he's about 10, 12 years away from his date, right? So there's lots of years for this thing to go on. And so year after year after year, John, this revival keeps getting hotter and hotter and hotter, and these dates that, you know, the 2 days and 2004 and a half, the week of Daniel is going to start, get emphasized over and over and over and over and over again. And Faith Assembly, I feel like Faith Assembly got worse with time. And it really took its turn into its really bad doomsday madness when this stuff started happening in the early 90s. And I'm telling you, John, all kinds of terrible stuff happened, you know, as a result of this, you know. People quit going to school, people quit saving for retirement, people didn't get education, you know, and everybody living through this, if you're growing up in this period of time, they're saying, oh, well, we'll never finish high school. Oh, we'll never get our license. We'll never get married. You know, it's the same stuff with 77, right? Same stuff's going on all the way through the message all along. And what happens, though, John, of course, as you and I well know, it is 2025 and we're still here, aren't we? So as you start to get close to the year 2000, Raymond Jackson starts to figure out this thing ain't going to work out. He starts to figure it out. Now, does he tell that to anybody? No, he does not say that to anybody. But he knows this thing is not going to get to work out. And what he does is he starts anybody who was not fully on board with his prediction, anyone who had not publicly came out and been on board, 100% agreement with his prediction, right? He one by one started to target them for purging, okay? Because when we get to the other side of it, they had to be gone. Otherwise, they would have been, you know, they could make him look bad, right? He only wanted people left that had agreed with him. That way, they could all be wrong together on the other side of it. Looking back, that's how I interpret what happened. And so he started purging people, John, and and he was never really upfront about what he was doing. He would find something else wrong with them that he didn't like about them. He didn't come out and say, you didn't agree with my 2004 and a half prediction. You got to go. And he found something else. Oh, you're stealing money. Or, you know, they'd make stuff up even, you know, to get rid of them. And he did that, John, he even did that to the man in our churches who probably would have been looked at like our second from the top, our second highest ranking apostle. He did that to him. And he was a minister from Europe. His name is Rolf Stroman. And as he did that to him, it started a massive schism, John, that crossed literally every church in our sect of the message. And schism them all. I mean, we lost about half the fellowship through that schism. And a lot of them, some of them ended up going with Rolf Stroman. A lot of them, I think, ended up in some other sects of the message. But it kept getting worse. You know, it kept getting worse. He kept schisming and schisming. We had another big schism with some of the local churches here over it. And by the time you get to 2004, John, okay, Raymond Jackson died in December of 2004. He died 6 months before his prediction date, John. 6 months before. And basically, that's kind of where I lend off my book. I took my book up to 2005. Come out over my peoples. I looked at the history of all these things. And there's way more details in the book, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to look in there. Come out over my people, volume 2. But basically, the Faith Assembly Fellowship collapsed after that. When Raymond Jackson died, there was a power struggle. A man named James Allen ended up taking over. He was kind of an incompetent man, and everything more or less fell apart at that point. And there's the Faith Assembly Fellowship has multiple subsects. I mean, the churches and people, a lot of them are still there. But the whole thing really fell apart as a unified group at that point, and most of them turned on each other. John, broke up hundreds of homes, hundreds of families, divorces. You know, when those things happen in our churches, you have to divorce your wife, you have to divorce your husband, you can't even see your kids again if they, you know, go on the other side. It was very, very ugly, John, and I lost most of my family, actually, through the early 2000s, through a lot of that stuff, and then it just got worse and worse with time.
Yeah, like I said, it's just really sad to think these were bullies. These ministers leading the charge were bullies, and they were put into their positions, many of them, by William Branham. If not put into the position by him, Branham supported many of these guys. And you just look at the way they act. Look at the way that they treat their congregation. And the ministers are supposed to be shepherds of the sheep, and instead, they're just brutally beating the sheep verbally. And I just have to go back and say, was God even in this? Was the Holy Spirit there? Because the Holy Spirit doesn't make men act like this. According to the Bible, it gives you meekness and love and gentleness and peace. And these guys have quite the opposite. And again, we go back to the propaganda of this. They're printing propaganda. They're getting people to come into the church so that they can treat them horrifically. And I'm almost at a loss for words at the things that have gone on in the cult, especially hearing some of the stories that you've talked about.
Yeah, you know, as I look at my sect of the message, you know, Raymond Jackson's a kind of a complicated figure. to the people who supported him, he was actually a super great guy, right? Like, I mean, he was, you know, top-notch kind of a person to the people who accepted his teachings, right? But to the people who did not accept his teachings, John, he definitely took a scorched earth approach. You know, I can think of people that he didn't like he labeled them as witches, right? And did horrible, horrible, horrible things to some of these people publicly, just destroyed people, John. He even personally drove a number of people to suicide that I'm aware of, you know, looking back as well. So it's like a mix, right? Like on one side of it, yeah, he was really nice, really kind to all the people who were on his side, but he was, you know, the devil incarnate to his enemies. So it's, you know, you got to balance all of that out. And yeah, there's so much more I could say, John, about all of his predictions about the end of days, but basically every last stitch of it fell through. All of it fell through, right? And it ended up being, and at this stage in time, you know, where we're at and the way the world is, it is absolutely impossible that what he taught can possibly even come to pass the way that he taught it. Like, it's just, the world has changed too much. Things have changed too much. His scenarios don't work anymore. It's just, it's just totally wrong, obviously, at this stage. But people go along with it. People have carried it on down to the present day. I mean, I was doing it myself here before, not all that long ago. And the one last thing, John, I think I will mention before we end this off. And like I said, again, if you all want even more details, like there's probably more details than I'm going to talk about as we go through each of these sects in the books. I believe it is. Yeah, here it is. Come Out of Her, My People, Volume 2. You know, there's lots of more details in here if you guys want them. But the last thing I want to point out about my sect of the message is shortly after Raymond Jackson died, I'll also put out there, I was a trustee on the board overseeing the finances of the institution as well, John. I was at the very top of this thing, okay, ladies and gentlemen? I just got to tell the truth. I was at the top of this thing. And Raymond Jackson, I mentioned Homer Brown, who was the editor of The Contender earlier on, right, who came from Bill Padaris' church. Well, he was also the original treasurer back in those days as well. And when Raymond Jackson and him had his falling out, Raymond Jackson took over managing the treasury from Homer Brown in the late 70s. Somewhere between there and the time that he died, Raymond Jackson began an embezzlement scheme, John, where he was paying, basically he channeled a percentage of the revenue coming in. A lot of it was the overseas tithe money coming from other churches, and then some of the local money as well, into an account that he never disclosed to the church board. And then out of that account, he would, I don't know if what you'd call it, would you use maybe a slush fund is the right count? He would use that money to pay salaries to most members of his family. He used that account to, you know, just do whatever he felt like he needed for ministry, but he never disclosed any of it to the church board. And the church board actually started to discover what he was doing in 1997, John. 1997, a leak of it got out, and the church board had a private meeting without him to just discuss if they should do anything. He found out they had a private meeting without him, okay? Wow. And the very next Sunday, like before they could even do anything, before he even knew what happened in the meeting, he dismissed the entire church board. He had a service where he basically hung them out and dried them and destroyed the reputation of every member of the church board. He just nailed them to a cross, John, right in church, and told everybody, you know, you got to believe me. These guys are, they have been a thorn in my side. And he said things like this in that sermon. You never heard the apostles giving a financial statement. You know, he said things like that. And looking back now, what a lot of red flags were in that sermon, John. But of course, sitting there back then, we're like, oh, these terrible deacons, how dare they be a thorn in his side? That's right. The apostles never gave financial statements. What are these people doing? And so he replaced the entire church board at that point, John, and he was able then to carry that on up until after he died. Then after he died, the church ran out of money because I told you about all those schisms that happened, right? Well, as all those schisms happened, well, guess what? A lot of the international money all dried up of all the other churches tithing back to Faith Assembly. And the people continued the embezzlement scheme after he died, okay? And the church ran dry. It had ran out of money, and it was a very ugly situation without a lot of details going into it, John. Actually, if people want, on my website, John, I actually have a full video where I talk through a lot of this in detail if people want more details. But at the end of the day, it turned out Raymond Jackson had been directing a multi-decade embezzlement scheme, most likely behind the scenes as well, in addition to all the schisms, in addition to all the doomsday dates, in addition to all this other stuff, you know. And it's just, you know, it's so challenging coming from this to know just exactly what to do with all of those pieces. But there you go, John. The history of Faith Assembly.
It's unbelievable, man. And so, like you said, there's so many puzzle pieces to this. I mean, Faith Assembly, remember, is just one component of the mess that William Branham created. And you NAR people who are watching or listening, think of that. I mean, think of just, and this is the oldest one, right? What was the year that the Faith Assembly branch was split? Do you remember?
So we split away in 1967, 1968. But the churches, like I said, this was the Second Message Church. This church was planted in the 50s, right along with some of the other oldest message churches. This was one of the very first churches that was started by the people who believed William Branham was Elijah.
Yeah, so early 50s. They said, according to the NAR, I just had this conversation with another person who's researching into Branham, and they said most of the NAR believe that it was like 1964, 65, he started whatever they call it in God's generals. He went astray or whatever. But no, man, in the 1950s, he's creating these sects that look, they resemble Christianity not at all. They resemble the other side of the evils in the world. I'll just say it like that in a nice way. But what they've created was not Christian at all. And these are from the early years of William Branham's ministry. And keep in mind, some of these sects went into isolationism, kind of like the, you know, Junior Jackson Faith Assembly. Others went on to build pillars that eventually grew into the NAR. So this is a big, big mess that we're going through, and we've just covered one pillar that grew into this mess. So I'm looking forward to getting into some of the other pillars.
For sure. You know, when I mentioned how we had that outpouring of the Holy Spirit in, starting at 93, 94, just before the Toronto Blessing happened. When the Toronto Blessing happened, John, we sent spies, right? We were taught, we were believing this is the false anointed ones that that William Branham told us about. So we knew, I mean, we knew from the beginning of really the things that kicked off the NAR, that they were descended from the message. We knew Paul Kane was involved in this. We knew Gordon Lindsay's people were involved in that from the very beginning. And we had in our belief set, based on William Branham Sermon's false anointed ones at the end time, we had the belief that at the end of days, when the true revival came to the message, a false revival would also start among the false anointed ones. And so when the Toronto blessing happened right after it, John, that was too much of a coincidence for us. And yeah, Raymond Jackson sent spies into some of these places to bring back reports about what was going on. And I have whole sermon recordings where they went through what the spies came back with, you know, and the reports and stuff. And basically the end of it is Raymond Jackson coming down to the conclusion, yes, I can confirm to you, this is the false anointed ones at the end time that are here with a false message. That is what we labeled that from the very beginning in our churches, John. Paul Kane, I could bring up recordings through that. Paul Kane ended up getting ripped left and right. Him and Lee Vail had their falling out right in that time. Perry Green's at the end of the day, Perry Green was the last one to keep being friends with Paul Kane, because everybody else was basically outraged that Paul Kane was involved with this false version of the message, you know. And the main thing is, I know people in the NAR, maybe the main thing was they A, did not accept William Branham as the Elijah, and they B, rejected the holiness standards, right? So you've got these people who believe 80% of the message, but they've rejected William Branham as Elijah, and they're not following the holiness standards. And it is just like anathema, right? It's almost like, and looking at it on this side, I know it the people in the NAR, it's kind of like cultural appropriation. You know what I mean? Our churches had lived this from the early days. They had poured in with their hearts and souls to slave after all of these rules and work so hard to get this rapturing faith. And then to see, like, these people kind of come and culturally appropriate the things of the message and steal and take these things and not give any credit back to the places that they come from. Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit offensive, I have to say, even back then. And that's part of why we labeled it. Like, look, they've just got a portion of the message. They're doing the thing they're doing. But obviously, this is the false revival to damn them all to hell. And we've got the real one here, and we're going to go to heaven. They're going to stay behind and burn up. And that is exactly how it was preached in our churches, John.
Well, Charles, I don't usually do this because I have strong disagreements with many of these guys, but I have to say that in the case of Raymond Jackson and his false anointed ones at the end time, I think he actually got that right. He just wasn't telling the whole story.
I agree. I think there was more than them, and I think a lot of them might have been in our camp, John.
Well, anyway, this has been fun. If you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and christiangospelchurch.org. For more about the history of William Branham and the healing revivals, you can read Come Out of Her, My People. And for more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.